Good day. Today is Wednesday, 22nd October 2025. And before I proceed with the substance of this video, let me just quickly again remind you to tick the like button if, having watched the video or that part of the video you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard. So let's proceed with what we're going to talk about today. And again, it is going to be about the conflict in Ukraine, which takes really extraordinary and at times very strange turns. And yesterday, I have to say, was one of the strangest, because back on Thursday of last week, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and Donald Trump, the president of the United States, had a 2.5 hour telephone conversation. They appeared to have agreed, or at least Donald Trump said that they had agreed, to a summit meeting in a few weeks' time in Budapest. The Russians, as we will see, were rather more reticent. And they agreed also that their foreign ministers, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and a Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, would first have a telephone call and then would meet, and that there would then be preparations made for this summit to take place in Budapest. And there was lots of discussion and commentary about this oncoming summit. And the Russians spoke about the preparations that they were making for the summit. And the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, and his Foreign Minister, Peter Szijjártó, talked about the preparations for the summit. And Orban telephoned both Putin and Trump to discuss the preparations for the summit. And after some uncertainty about how President Putin's plane would reach Budapest, the Bulgarian government announced that it would make its airspace available for President Putin's presidential flight, and US Secretary of State Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov then had their telephone call, and everything seemed to be moving forward, and there was talk that there would be a meeting, an actual in-person meeting between Lavrov and Rubio, perhaps in Budapest, perhaps tomorrow on Thursday, 23rd October 2025. And, well, then reports started to circulate in parts of the media, initially I think CNN, suggesting that the telephone call between Rubio and Lavrov had actually not gone well. I remember noticing that there were comments to this effect on social media as well. Basically, it struck me from people who didn't really want the summit meeting between Trump and Putin to happen. And then reports also began to appear that the White House had informed the media that the summit meeting between Trump and Putin had been postponed. And then the media started to write that the summit meeting had indeed postponed, or in the case of some parts of the British media, that it had been straightforwardly cancelled. And we then got reports that the European Union, the various European countries, the Coalition of the Willing, President Macron and Prime Minister Starmer's Coalition of the Willing, the European countries that have discussed and talked about and held endless meetings about deploying peacekeeping forces or reassurance forces or whatever sort of forces they want to call them to Ukraine, that they all come together and that they were working on a 12-point peace plan that they were going to propose to Trump. And this peace plan basically envisaged a ceasefire, in effect a freezing of the conflict, on the existing conflict lines. The proposal first made by General Kellogg back in April 2024, in April last year, and the one that General Kellogg has stuck with ever since, that President Trump has at various times adopted, but which in Alaska, over the course of his meeting with Putin, Trump appeared to walk back from. And then we got more comments from President Trump himself. President Trump said that he hadn't yet decided, or hasn't yet decided, whether he's going to meet with President Putin of Russia at all. He might do, or then he might not do. He doesn't want to waste his time by a pointless meeting. And, well, everything is in the air. And the reporting, the commentary, is united in saying that the reason that the Rubio-Lavrov telephone call went wrong is because the Americans were very dissatisfied, surprised and dissatisfied that over the course of the call, Lavrov stuck to Russia's maximalist position that there cannot be a ceasefire on the existing contact lines, and that the first step, the Russians are not going to agree to such a ceasefire, and that the Americans don't want to have a meeting in Budapest, a meeting between Trump and Putin, which will not result in a ceasefire. Now, I've tried to set this all out as neutrally as possible, but this is absolutely bizarre. It is completely extraordinary. And the first point I'm going to make, and it's a very simple one, but it's the one that we all need to keep in mind, is that in Alaska, when Trump and Putin met, the one thing, as I have pointed out many times, that we know for sure came out of the discussion was an agreement between Trump and Putin, an agreement which, in a subsequent Truth Social post, Donald Trump set out in writing, whereby there would be no interim ceasefire, that the two sides, Ukraine and Russia, should move forward with negotiations right away, without waiting for a ceasefire, and that the way to resolve the conflict was not through a ceasefire followed by negotiations, but by negotiations, direct negotiations, which would result in a full and final settlement, a comprehensive settlement of the conflict. And for my part, I have pointed out that most conflicts that are negotiated are settled in this way. For example, the negotiations which took place in Paris during the Vietnam War took place despite the fact that there was no ceasefire between the North and South Vietnamese and between the North Vietnamese and the United States. There were negotiations even as the fighting continued, and eventually there was an agreement. But there was no ceasefire until that agreement was reached. So there is nothing unprecedented or extraordinary or unusual in the Russian position. And as I have just said, it is one which President Trump himself back in August adopted. Anyway, is this narrative that we're being spun that Lavrov and Rubio had a bad call, that the Americans were surprised and taken aback by the fact that the Russians were not agreeing to a ceasefire right away, and that there wouldn't be a ceasefire agreed at the Budapest summit meeting. Is this true? Well, the first thing to do, I think, is to go back to what each government has actually said about the Lavrov-Rubio meeting, the telephone conversation, and to see whether or not the readouts that each government published suggests that there really was some kind of row or argument over the course of the call, and that this call was indeed the event which precipitated the apparent collapse of the Budapest summit. Well, let's start with what the Russians say. And the Russian account is contained in a very brief readout. Both readouts are very brief. On October 20th, Foreign Minister Lavrov held a telephone conversation with US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The parties engaged in a constructive discussion, focusing on possible specific steps to implement the understandings reached during President Putin's October 16th telephone conversation with US President Donald Trump. Well, it doesn't tell us much, but it tells us that the Russians considered the conversation to be constructive. Now let's go to what the Americans say, and I should say, by the way, in briefly, that the American readout came out just before the Russian one. So this is the American readout. The Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke today with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to discuss next steps following the October 16th call between President Trump and President Putin. The secretary emphasized the importance of upcoming engagements as an opportunity for Moscow and Washington to collaborate on advancing a durable resolution of the Russia-Ukraine war in line with President Trump's vision. Now, maybe this is slightly less positive about the call than the Russian readout. It doesn't refer to a constructive call, but it absolutely does not imply a breakdown. On the contrary, it says that the two foreign ministers discussed the next steps following the October 16th call between President Trump and Putin. Next steps clearly implies that these are steps leading up to the summit meeting in Budapest. So a discussion takes place. They're talking about the next steps. They're clearly planning ahead. There's no sign here from these words that there's a feeling in Washington after the conversation that the entire summit should be called off. And then we're told that the secretary emphasized the importance of upcoming engagements as an opportunity for Moscow and Washington to collaborate on advancing a durable resolution of the Russia-Ukraine war. Upcoming engagements presumably refers first to the meeting between Rubio and Lavrov in Budapest, which apparently was intended to happen tomorrow, and then obviously the forthcoming meeting between Trump and Putin, which was supposed to happen later in Budapest as well. And we are told that Moscow and Washington should collaborate on advancing a durable resolution of the Russia-Ukraine war. And notice there's no reference here to a ceasefire, nothing like that at all. We read instead about a durable resolution of the Russia-Ukraine war, which is more consistent with what President Trump appears to have agreed or did agree with Putin at the Alaska summit, which is that there should not be a ceasefire, but a full, final, comprehensive, lasting resolution of the Russia-Ukraine war. And I would argue that the word durable resolution is more consistent with that. So there is absolutely nothing about either readout to suggest a difficult, tumultuous call, strong disagreements between the two foreign ministers, the Americans bringing up the topic of a ceasefire, the Russians disagreeing with the idea of a ceasefire, and that disagreement being sufficient by itself to wreck the idea of holding the summit. Now, the Russians are playing bewildered about the whole business. And by the way, so are the Hungarians. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov has given an extensive discussion of his conversation with Rubio and of the state of play as the Russians understood it. He did this yesterday over the course of a press conference that was held following a meeting in Moscow between Lavrov and the foreign minister of Ethiopia. And Lavrov says this: "Yesterday, I engaged in a comprehensive discussion with US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, in line with the agreement reached by the presidents of Russia and the United States on October 16th during their telephone conversation. We reaffirmed our steadfast commitment to proceed in accordance with the understandings and agreements reached between Presidents Putin and Trump, primarily in Alaska, as well as during their subsequent telephone exchanges." Now, here we go. You notice again, understandings and agreements. And we know that one of these agreements, we know this definitely because Trump confirmed it in writing, is the agreement that they reached in Alaska, that there should be no ceasefire, that the way to resolve the conflict was to move forward towards a final, full, durable resolution of the whole conflict. And Lavrov continues with Secretary Rubio: "We reviewed the current state of affairs and explored how to finalise the broadly agreed upon framework for another meeting, which the US president proposed should be held in Budapest." Now, that does not say that it was Trump who suggested the Budapest meeting, but it does say that Trump suggested the meeting in Budapest. I have no doubt that the idea for a summit meeting in Budapest originated, or at least was floated, over the course of the telephone conversation between Putin and Trump on from the American side. Ushakov's briefing after that conversation refers merely to a possible summit meeting. So there's no indication there that the Russians agreed to a summit meeting. Whereas Trump, in the Truth Social post that he published after the conversation, and by the way, before Ushakov gave his briefing, specifically said that there would be a summit meeting, that Putin and Trump had agreed to a summit meeting and that it would be held in Budapest. And anyway, Lavrov confirms that it was indeed Trump who suggested Budapest as the venue. As I have already explained, I believe that the original idea for a follow-up summit to the one in Alaska probably came from Orban, and that it was Orban who suggested Budapest as the location. And then anyway, Lavrov continues: "Naturally, the focus is not on the location, though the venue does matter in this context, given commotion stirred by those who oppose a European Union as an association of sovereign states and prefer all decisions to be made by its Brussels bureaucracy," which is a very interesting form of words, which I'm going to skip over. Suffice to say that there's been massive opposition in Europe to the holding of a summit meeting between Putin and Trump, and massive opposition to that meeting taking place in Budapest, in the capital of a country which is a member of the European Union. In fact, Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, has gone so far as to say that if Putin's plane tried to fly to Budapest across Polish airspace, the Poles reserve the right to bring it down. An extraordinary threat, one which in any other time period, at any point, for example, during the Cold War, or indeed after, would have provoked a storm of criticism and protest, but which Sikorsky says, and nobody in the West seems to care about. Poland threatening, in effect, to shoot down the plane carrying the president of Russia, the president of the world's leading nuclear power, of a country which has the capability, apparently, or so people say, to destroy all human life. Apparently, this is something that the Polish foreign minister is happy to talk about. And as I said, nobody in the West seems to mind. Anyway, let's press on. The key issue, however, remains not the place or the timing, but how we advance on the substantive tasks agreed upon, those which garnered broad consensus in Anchorage. And to repeat again what I said in my recent programme, it's absolutely clear that the problem, the crisis in relations between the United States and Russia that has developed over the last few weeks, the reason why Putin has come in for a degree of criticism in Russia itself, the reason that there have been strong statements from various Russian officials about the current situation, is in part because proposals were made to the Americans in Anchorage, at the summit meeting in Anchorage, and the Russians are becoming very frustrated that the American side has not responded. They have not so far replied. Lavrov explained it all in detail in an interview that he gave some days ago to the Russian newspaper Kommersant, which I have discussed in previous programmes. And then Lavrov continues, "We agreed to continue these telephone consultations to better assess where we stand and determine the right way forward." So it's clear the Russians see any prospective summit meeting between Trump and Putin as a follow-up to the meeting in Alaska. And what they want is Trump's answer to the proposals, the ideas that were floated and discussed between Putin and Trump in Alaska. Now, I don't know what these ideas and proposals are, but media reports have suggested that the ideas consisted of Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, a complete Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, and possibly a ceasefire in Kherson region and Zaporozhye region on the existing contact lines. To repeat again, I don't know that that is the case. The Russians have never said that publicly or officially. I said that I personally could imagine that something like that might have been discussed and perhaps even proposed, or at least floated. And the Russians might indeed have asked Trump for his final thoughts about this and might be waiting for Trump to respond. But so far he hasn't done so. And clearly, over the course of the telephone call between Putin and Trump on Thursday, Putin clearly pressed Trump on this question, and as far as the Russians are concerned, to come back to the key point, the meeting in Budapest is intended to provide Trump with the opportunity to reply. Anyway, let's continue further with what Lavrov said. "Today, I was surprised to read a CNN report suggesting that the meeting between Putin and Trump may be postponed, as US officials concluded after our yesterday's call with Secretary Rubio that Russia's position has barely shifted since the initial talks and remains wedded to its original maximalist demands. The lack of integrity in many Western media outlets is well known. CNN, too, has earned its reputation in this regard. They tend to favour simplistic slogans, injected and hammered home to the audience, over serious analytical work. I wish to officially confirm that Russia has not altered its positions from the understandings achieved during the extensive negotiations between Putin and Trump in Alaska. So whatever was discussed in Alaska, maybe, as I said, this proposal that the Russians cease fire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, provided the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass, and the undoubted agreement which has been officially and publicly confirmed, that there be no ceasefire and that parties instead proceed directly to a full, final, conclusive settlement of the conflict. The Russians are sticking to that position. They're saying that there's nothing maximalist about our demands. We are sticking to the same things that we discussed with Trump in Alaska. We are still waiting for his reply. He hasn't told us yet whether he agrees or whether he doesn't, and if he does agree, how we're supposed to take this process forward. And then Lavrov continues, the understandings are grounded in the agreements reached at the time, which President Trump succinctly summarized when he stated that what is needed is a long-term sustainable peace, not an immediate ceasefire that would lead nowhere. And that indeed is what Trump said, and it is there in his Truth Social post. We remain fully committed to this formula, as I reiterated yesterday in my conversation with Secretary Rubio. Now, voices from Washington suggest that we must immediately cease all further discussion and let history judge. But stopping now would mean ignoring the root causes of this conflict, causes clearly understood and articulated by the US administration upon President Trump's inauguration. I am referring to ensuring Ukraine's non-aligned, neutral and nuclear-free status, which entails abandoning any attempts to draw it into NATO. I am also referring to ending the de facto annihilation of Russian and Russian-speaking populations, a policy pursued by the Kiev regime. And then he goes into a great deal about all of that, and he discusses the negative and impossible positions of the European governments. And he says that they've now stopped talking about inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia. They've begun calling instead for an immediate ceasefire, as, by the way, have the Ukrainians. And then Lavrov continues, most importantly, a ceasefire would not only allow for the rearmament of the Kiev regime, but also encourages terrorist activities, strikes on civilian infrastructure, attacks on civilians on Russian soil, sabotage operations like the Nord Stream bombings. And then he talks about how the Poles are refusing to extradite individuals who the Germans say, Ukrainian individuals who the Germans say carried out the Nord Stream attacks. And he also complains about the fact that the Poles have basically threatened to close their airspace to President Putin's plane and have threatened the safety of President Putin's aircraft. And then Lavrov finishes, let me repeat an immediate ceasefire, suddenly back on the agenda as opposed to addressing the root causes of the conflict, would mean only one thing, that a vast portion of Ukraine remains under regime rule. And that, by the way, tells us something else, that the regime, the Russian objective, is indeed the change of the regime in Kiev. The objective, the Russian objective, is indeed regime change. But we will hold that back. The point is that the Russians are not going to agree to a ceasefire. And he finishes, those now lobbying our American colleagues to abandon their stance on long-term sustainable settlement are the same forces behind the push to basically support the Kiev regime. We know who is handling this, Zelensky's European patrons and masters. Such an approach runs entirely counter to what Presidents Putin and Trump agreed upon in Anchorage, focusing on root causes, rejecting Ukraine's NATO integration. That is an interesting further confirmation that Trump told Putin that he opposed Ukraine's membership of NATO, just say, and fully securing the lawful rights of Russian and Russian-speaking populations. And Lavrov again hints that this was something that Trump also agreed to in Anchorage. We remain ready to continue this work. So the Russians are furious, and that is the only way to describe Lavrov's comments. They are furious. They have been pressing Trump for an answer to what they believe they had agreed with him in Anchorage. Trump, over the course of the telephone call with Putin on Thursday, obviously didn't give a clear answer, but suggested a summit meeting in Budapest instead. And the Americans again seem to be running away from that summit meeting in Budapest, presumably because they're still finding it impossible to give the answer to the question, whatever that question is, that the Russians are asking. Well, I'm going to say something straight away. There are a lot of people who are trying to analyse and understand Donald Trump's foreign policy, and specifically in connection with the Ukraine conflict, his approach to the conflict itself and to Russia. And every so often we come up with all kinds of theories about some strategy that President Trump himself is following. Some say that he is trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the neocons and the hardliners in Washington and in Europe, and that in private he's reached all kinds of agreements and understandings with the Russians that he intends to move forward, and that all of this is smoke and mirrors and theatre in order to keep these hardline critics of his policy confused and under control. Others have an entirely different opposite view. They think that President Trump is leading the Russians along. He has some kind of malignant plan to somehow trick them into some kind of freeze of the conflict on the existing conflict lines, presumably so as to insert NATO peacekeepers into Western Ukraine or something like that, and that this is all a huge act of duplicity and trickery against the Russians. I don't see evidence for either of these things in these exchanges. In truth, if I have to say it, this all looks to me like the actions of a confused old man in a hurry deeply out of his depth, blundering around, bewildered, giving different responses as various people speak to him. So he had a telephone call with Putin on Thursday. Putin told him straight out, we're winning the war if you supply Tomahawks or deploy Tomahawks in Ukraine. That's it. Our discussions are over. And please, what is your response to what we discussed back in Anchorage in August? You told me then that you would go off, consult with your officials in Washington, speak with the Ukrainians and the Europeans, and you would come back to me with an answer. And instead of giving that answer over the course of a 2.5 hour call, Trump tells Putin, let's have another meeting, this time in Budapest. And then Trump, on the following day, meets Zelensky. Putin's words are ringing in his ears. He knows perfectly well that he hasn't given the Russians the answer that they're seeking. He understands now that the Tomahawks would indeed be a deal breaker. He then turns on Zelensky, tries to get Zelensky to agree to a pullout from Donbass. Zelensky has told us that that was indeed what Trump told him to do. He told Zelensky that if Ukraine doesn't agree to the pullout from Donbass, then Ukraine risks being destroyed. Zelensky predictably says no. There's a row. There's raised voices. There's angry words. Zelensky goes away, immediately says that as far as he's concerned, the only acceptable way forward is a freeze of the conflict on the existing conflict lines. The various people in Washington, presumably Kellogg, Waltz, Susie Wiles, for all I know, who knows who else, and of course the various European governments line up again and back Zelensky, and so Trump flips again. And he is going back on everything he agreed and said to Putin, and he now says again, well, the best way forward is a freeze on the existing conflict lines. And I get to say it, if there's been a decision to postpone the summit meeting, it's not because the Russians are adopting a maximalist position or anything like that. It's that Trump cannot bring himself to give that answer to Putin he said he would give to Putin in Anchorage, and which Trump himself is afraid to give. Trump cannot make up his mind about this. He cannot decide whether agreeing with Putin is the right way forward to end the war. That is what Witkoff is telling him. Or whether instead he should stick with the Ukrainians and with the Europeans and instead continue to stick to the Kellogg formula of a ceasefire on conflict lines. And because Trump cannot make up his mind, because Trump wants to avoid a showdown with Putin in which he tells Putin that he's going to stick with Kellogg, going back on what they discussed in Anchorage, and because he doesn't want to tell the Europeans that he's going to instead go with Putin and agree to Putin's ideas and formulas about how the conflict should end, he is avoiding or trying to avoid having the meeting in Budapest. That is my analysis. And I think if you go through all of the various words and discussions, the American readout of the Rubio-Lavrov call, if you read the Russian readout of the Rubio-Lavrov call, if you look at what Lavrov himself has said, you could see, I think, fairly clearly what has happened. Trump doesn't want to commit himself fully either to one side or another. He is constantly trying instead to split the difference. He understands, he's long understood, that his limitage over the Russians is very limited. It basically is non-existent. He's just admitted, incidentally, that he is not going to impose massive tariffs on China if the Chinese buy Russian oil. He says that he's doing that because he wants to be nice to China. He's saying this even as he is threatening China with 157% tariffs on the 1st of November, unless China withdraws its recent decision to impose licenses on people who buy from China rare earths. No sign, by the way, that the Chinese are doing that. Incidentally, just as Trump ducks and weaves and won't either commit or not commit to meeting meeting Putin in Budapest next week, the week after, at any particular point in time, so Trump is doing the same with Xi Jinping. One moment he's going to meet Xi Jinping at the APEC summit in South Korea. The next moment he's not going to meet Xi Jinping at this summit meeting. As things stand, the very latest reports suggest that the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping is again in doubt. Again, one could see a president, Donald Trump, sensing, I suspect, that he's out of his depth, unable to make up his mind about what to do, confronted by a variety of pressures, frightened of being blamed if anything goes wrong, and procrastinating and coming up with excuses to put off both meetings, even as things continue to drift towards the inevitable conclusion. In each case, a Russian military victory in Ukraine and an economic war with China. I have to say that it is a painful contrast with Trump's sure touch in terms of his conduct of domestic political affairs within the United States itself. His handling, for example, of the closure, the government shutdown, in which he has managed to arrange things so that that event has played out to his advantage, is in extreme contrast to his complete inability to manage these negotiations with the Chinese and the Russians. I would add that his triumphant agreement of a couple of last week, the Gaza ceasefire, now already hangs by a thread. Israel has again bombed Gaza. They claim to remain committed to the ceasefire. I have my massive doubts about this myself. I've made that already very clear. But again, it's obvious that nothing has been finally concluded or agreed, again, because the president himself does not know his own mind. Anyway, that is my own view about the situation. Now, Orban and Szijjártó, the prime minister and foreign minister of Hungary, as I am making this program, are still working overtime, trying to save the summit meeting. By the way, if it doesn't take place, it will be a major blow for Orban, having been promised a summit meeting. If it really doesn't happen, then, well, Orban will be in an extremely difficult position, an extremely embarrassed position. And anyway, that's a topic for another day. But as I said, the Hungarians are trying to find a way out. And for the record, so at the moment are the Russians. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, has given a number of comments about the preparations. He said, we continue the preparations for the summit. We believe that we should focus on the content, and this is what we are doing on the orders given by President Putin. Such issues as schedules, formats, and sequence of steps are largely derivative from the content. Naturally, attempts have been made to present the situation as something different from what it was a week, 2 or 3 weeks ago. I view this as a deliberate aspiration of the deal's opponents to reduce chances for its conclusion. We say that preparations for the summit go on. They may have different forms. He did, however, go on to say there is no agreement as to the timing and location of the summit. And nonetheless, he says, I want in advance to warn those who will again start writing that something was cancelled against doing it. So the Hungarians are trying to get this process back on track. And as I said, they have a personal stake in doing so. And the Russians still want to see what Trump is going to do. But to repeat again, whatever goodwill there is towards Trump in Moscow is going to be further damaged by this experience. And it makes it even more likely if the meeting in Budapest does take place that the Russians, Putin, will insist on Trump's reply to whatever proposals or questions or agreements or prospective agreements the Russians suggested to him in Anchorage. And what those are, well, Lavrov has at least made clear in one respect, definitely no NATO for Ukraine. And unquestionably, I think on this everybody has agreed, a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. Anyway, there we are. That is the diplomacy or non-diplomacy at the moment. It is chaos and muddle. And of course, the people who don't want the summit to happen and who don't want any negotiation process to take place, the Europeans and the Ukrainians, are busy and they're coming up with their completely unacceptable 12-point plan. This is another example, by the way, of Eve Smith's principle that the Western powers spend all their time negotiating with each other and don't pay any attention to what the other side thinks. So when they do finally present their ideas to the other side, they discover to their astonishment that the other side is not interested in what they have spent an inordinate amount of time painstakingly negotiating with each other. Anyway, the Europeans are coming up with their 12-point plan, which I suspect they know perfectly well is a plan the Russians are going to reject. And, well, the Ukrainians are busy. There have been some sabotage attacks on industrial facilities in Hungary. There's no proof yet as to who was responsible. But I have to say that suspicions that the Ukrainians were involved must now be very strong. And as we will see in a moment, the Ukrainians claim to have carried out another missile strike on an industrial facility in pre-2014 Russia. We will discuss all of that very soon. So anyway, there we go. That is the state of the negotiations or non-negotiations at the moment. My guess, by the way, for the record, is that in one form or another, somehow or other, a Putin-Trump meeting will take place over the next few weeks. It may be in Budapest. It might be somewhere else. The Russians have never been keen on Budapest for all the many reasons that people have talked about. It is likely that Orban will participate, whether it is held in Budapest or not. But I predict that whatever the Russians expect to come of that summit will be disappointed. They will be disappointed because we will have the same swamp of inability on the part of the president and his officials to follow through with whatever it is that the Russians think they might have agreed. There have been skeptics about this whole process in Moscow for many months now. I have discussed this in recent programs. Those skeptics have become more open and more critical, including critical of Putin himself. Whilst I still think that there will be a summit, I remain of the view that it is likely, in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, to be the last one. Anyway, let's now turn to the military situation, because of course this is where the great paradox remains, because all of these attempts that the Europeans are making and the Ukrainians are making to prevent a serious negotiation to end the conflict from taking place are happening without any regard to the actual military situation on the battlefields. As I pointed out yesterday, Zelensky himself is now admitting that the Ukrainians are facing serious problems in Pokrovsk. They're facing problems in many other places too. And they have no response to these problems, and nor do the Europeans. Lord Richards, the former head of the British military, says the same thing. In terms of sanctions pressure, well, perhaps the person who has more knowledge of sanctions than anybody else outside the Russian finance ministry and the US Treasury Department, the former British diplomat Ian Proud, the man who signed off on many of the sanctions that Britain has imposed against Russia, has recently participated in a debate on this very topic. He has also published, as a follow-up to that debate, a brilliant article on his blog, The Peacemonger, in which he explains thoroughly and carefully and precisely, firstly, that the sanctions have never achieved their objective. They've not softened Russian policy. They have hardened Russian policy. They have made the Russians even more convinced that the West is hostile to them, and hostile to them with respect to Ukraine. And of course, the Russians consistently to toughen their position. And the sanctions also have never had the devastating impact on the Russian economy that is imagined or promised by their creators, by their originators. Again, it's worth reading the article to see how thoroughly and carefully and systematically Ian Proud, who, by the way, to disclose, is a personal friend, goes through all of these various points. So, in the absence of this, the Europeans and the Ukrainians are sabotaging all attempts to achieve peace in a war which they're going to lose. Again, understanding the logic here, trying to find some kind of strategic reasoning behind this is incredibly, bizarrely difficult. The Europeans continue to insist that there must be no Russian veto on Ukraine's right to apply or achieve NATO membership and EU membership. Is this principle, which, by the way, has no existence, it's entirely an invention of the last 10, 15 years. This principle is apparently so important that Ukraine itself must be destroyed in order to uphold it. I mean, to me, that is frankly ridiculous. It's been said by me, that the Europeans would prefer a bad outcome to the war in Ukraine than a peace settlement if it ensures that the Americans stay. But of course, that ignores the fact that if there is a comprehensive defeat in Ukraine, that might in fact persuade some people in the United States. In fact, it is more likely to persuade people in the United States that it is indeed time to leave. The Europeans are unable to sort out their own security. They depend always on the United States, and the United States has more important things to do. A newspaper in the United States, a very, very anti-Chinese newspaper, but one which broadly supports President Trump, has written a long piece, which I was reading yesterday. I'm not going to, by the way, discuss the newspaper. I consider it, well, it's not a newspaper I usually read. Let's put it like that. Anyway, this long piece talks about how the United States has repeatedly got itself bogged down and distracted in conflict after conflict around the world, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Ukraine. It's suffered all kinds of financial and economic problems, which this article doesn't say are connected to American foreign policy, though in my opinion, all of these problems, all of them, have that one point of origin. And how China, the great enemy, according to this article, has exploited and benefited from everyone. And I can't help but think that more and more Americans are going to be saying this. They're going to be saying, I should stress, hawkish, hardline Americans are going to be saying this. Why are we wasting our time with the Europeans? They can't get their act together. We're exhausting ourselves. We're depleting our own inventories in conflicts that the Europeans themselves have brought upon themselves and which they are incapable of dealing with without our help. We got China to think about. Let's forget about the Europeans. It's time that they looked after themselves. Well, I am sure, as I said, that if there is a defeat in Ukraine, that argument in the United States is going to grow. Nobody in Europe apparently considers that or worries about that. Nobody in Europe wants to face the fact that the enormous economic malaise that exists across Europe is connected to this foreign policy. In France, as most of you probably know, there's been a heist. armed robbers broke into the Louvre Museum and stole jewels there, valuable jewels, jewels, some of which, by the way, I have seen, and which are indeed the kind of items which would be part of the crown jewels of many countries. And it's fascinating to see the excuses that are being made, that the Louvre is underfunded, that the security systems in the Louvre are inadequate. Well, they are obviously inadequate, but it's not because the Louvre is underfunded. Its funding has increased massively over the last 10 years. It has increased substantially beyond the rate of inflation. The number of security guards at the Louvre is about the same as it was 5 years ago and 10 years ago. It is true that the Louvre over the last 30 years has been expanded perhaps inordinately within the building, but I can't help but think that the affair of the stolen jewels in the Louvre must be seen as another example of the incompetent maladministration, the decay that we see in so much of Europe today, that even that, even the basic security systems to protect valuable jewels cannot be protected, cannot be secured properly any longer in ways that would undoubtedly have been the case just a few years ago. On that point, by the way, I would just say that on the eve of the French Revolution, there was another famous jewel robbery, the affair of the diamond necklace, whose details I am not going to discuss in this program. But anyway, that too was seen by many people in France as symptomatic of the institutional decay of the old regime. And I can't help but feel that there are some parallels in the situation today in France. Anyway, to repeat again, there is no plan, there is no idea. In Europe, axiomatically, all moves to negotiate a resolution of the war, plans conducted however chaotically, however confusedly by Donald Trump, must be axiomatically opposed. There must be a constant drumbeat for more and more escalation, more and more sanctions, more and more weapons, even though the weapons increasingly don't exist, even though when weapons are supplied, they don't achieve the results expected of them, even as Ian Proud has pointed out, the sanctions don't work. Just go on doing this, more of the same, even as defeat looms, the economic crisis in Europe deepens. Anyway, let's, with that, return to the situation in Ukraine. And the first thing to say is that last night, Ukraine conducted its own big drone attacks against Russia yesterday. According to the Russians, these drone attacks did not achieve very much, but there is a twist, because the Ukrainians are claiming that they carried out an attack with storm shadows against a Russian industrial facility in Bryansk, which is within pre-2014 Russia. Storm shadows are, of course, British-supplied missiles. The attacks on Bryansk, on the power station, it's a chemical plant, not a power station, on the chemical plant in Bryansk, the guidance for the storm shadows to strike this facility would have had to be provided by the United States. Of course, a few days ago, about a week ago, we got the reports that President Trump, back in July, took the decision to provide Ukraine, and presumably Britain, with the intelligence support to conduct strikes like this. As has been discussed many times, missile strikes against Russia, against pre-2014 Russia, were declared by President Putin back in the spring of 2024, when they were first discussed. They were discussed by President Putin as a red line. He said that they would be an indication that Britain and other Western countries, and of course the United States, were conducting strikes against Russia. Strikes like that were conducted by the Ukrainians and the British and the French and the Americans in the last weeks of the Biden administration. Donald Trump gave an interview to, I think it was Time magazine, that he vehemently opposed them. Strikes like that then stopped. Well, if these reports from the Ukrainians are true, then they have resumed. And resumed even as purported discussions for a summit meeting between Trump and Putin supposedly are underway. Now, the Ukrainians claim that they have completely destroyed with these missiles the Bryansk chemical facility. That is extremely unlikely, even if more than one storm shadow was able to hit the facility. I am not familiar with the Bryansk chemical plant, but chemical plants are enormous industrial facilities. As a general rule, they are very resilient, and it is most unlikely that a single strike against a facility of that scale would have resulted in its complete destruction. Damage might have been done. Damage probably has been done. But usually it can be repaired, and a factory like that can be brought back into production within a couple of days sometimes, or at most a few weeks. That, of course, is on the assumption that the missiles got through and that the missiles were launched at all. As of the time of making this program, the Russian Defense Ministry has not confirmed or discussed this attack, and I have not seen any comment about it on the usual Russian Telegram channels that I go to. Sometimes the Russians do hold back comment about attacks of this kind for some time. We will wait and see whether they do, whether they confirm that the attack took place, and if so, what it achieved. And we will also have to wait and see the Russian reaction. If the Ukrainians did carry out this attack in the way that is said, obviously with the assistance of the British, and ultimately with intelligence provided by the United States, then I have to see this as a further attempt by people in Kiev and London, and some people in Washington too, to throw a spoke, to put a spoke in the preparations for the summit meeting between Putin and Trump. It's the kind of thing that might very well result in the Russians deciding to call the entire summit meeting off. Anyway, let's wait and see. Now, the Russians have conducted a drone and missile strike of their own. And by the way, and just to make this clear, this drone and missile strike cannot have been in response to the attack on Bryansk, on the chemical plant in Bryansk. It's clearly an attack that the Russians prepare and plan in advance, in the way that they plan and prepare in advance all their missile and air attacks on Ukraine. And apparently it was another big one. And again, facilities, many facilities in Kiev were attacked. I don't yet know the full details. Presumably, the Russian Defense Ministry will provide them in their next update, and I will return to that topic tomorrow. I would add that the blog Events in Ukraine has discussed further the difference in the air war, the war in the sky between the Ukrainians and the Russians. I've discussed this in many places. I have discussed an article that appeared some months ago, written by an American entrepreneur of Ukrainian extraction, who also discussed the drone war between the two sides and confirmed many of the things that I had to say. And the article in Events in Ukraine does the same. I've said that there is a fundamental difference between the way the Russians conduct drone warfare, which is that for them, it is a massive industrial undertaking with drones produced to standardized shapes and sizes and capabilities in big factories, big series production of drones underway, that enables the Russians to scale up technological inputs into the drones, whereas the Ukrainian drone industry is fragmented and artisanal, carried out in small workshops by independent producers. And instead of producing a coherent, stable system of drones, is producing instead a chaotic and unmanageable zoo. And this article, Events in Ukraine, by the way, clarifies Ukraine's problem with fiber optic drones. The Russians perfected this technology last year. They're now using it continuously and extensively. It is perhaps the most widely used type of FPV drone that the Russians now use on the front lines. The Ukrainians also have fiber optic drones, but according to Ukrainian commentators, their fiber optic drones are badly made, of indifferent quality. More often than not, they break down or don't work. And this explains why Ukraine has been unable to match the Russians in this technology. The Russians, by the way, are now advancing with further types of drones. I remember about 2 years ago, there was a lot of debate about the vast fleet of AI drones that Ukraine was going to field. There's no sign that the Ukrainians have managed to achieve anything like that. I discussed it extensively when all of these reports about the AI drones that Ukraine was about to produce were circulating. It is the Russians, unsurprisingly, who are now starting to deploy AI drones which can guide themselves to the target, select targets, maneuver, do all of those kind of things that AI technology is supposed to enable. And of course, the jet-powered Garand drones are also now starting to appear, and they're starting to appear in ever greater quantities, and the Ukrainians have all but admitted that they have no ability to shoot them down. Anyway, all of that is going on. In addition, the Russians are indeed now deploying jet-powered, FAB, precision-guided bombs. these are starting to appear increasingly, apparently, in the sky. Some of these bombs, because of the jet engines that are attached to them, have ranges supposedly of up to 200 kilometers, and it is increasingly clear that they operate, that they cover the whole range of fab bombs, not just the lighter 250 kilo bombs, but going all the way up to the 500 and 1500 kilo bombs, and who knows, perhaps in time, the 3000 kilo bombs as well. Anyway, so the war in the sky continues, and whatever the Ukrainians might have achieved against the chemical factory in Bryansk, it was the Russian strike last night that was clearly far and away bigger and much more devastating. But we also are getting more reports from the ground. And again, the key crisis point still appears to be Pokrovsk. There's now film which appears to confirm that the Russians have now broken into Mirnograd from another place. There is actually extensive fighting now apparently taking place in Mirnograd, and the reports that the Russians control all of Pokrovsk south of the railway lines, except perhaps for a few isolated buildings that Ukrainian stragglers still are holding out in, that they do indeed appear to be true. And it does seem that there is fighting going on north of the railway lines, and that the Russians have indeed captured the industrial zone to the northwest of Pokrovsk. So the crisis for the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk is indeed worsening, and worsening by the hour. And again, more and more reports that the Ukrainians there are not going to be able to keep fighting, continue fighting in Pokrovsk for very long. Perhaps even more dramatic news, though hardly more consequential news, has come from Zaporozhye region. There are reports that the Russians have advanced from Rabotino, a place that many of us remember. It was the village that the Ukrainians basically broke their teeth on during their summer 2023 offensive. It is now firmly under Russian control. Anyway, the Russians appear to have advanced from Rabotino and appear to be storming the village of Malaya Tokmachka immediately to the north. This is a village from which the Ukrainians conducted part of their 2023 offensive. Apparently, a Russian force was able to break into Malaya Tokmachka, and there are some reports that the entire village, apart from a woman's prison, which is located to the south, has fallen under the control of the Russians. There is no doubt that the Russians are indeed in Malaya Tokmachka. They've made various attacks on Malaya Tokmachka in the past. The Ukrainians have always managed up to now to push the Russians back. But this time, it seems that the Russians broke into Malaya Tokmachka against slight opposition, and that the entire village, or at least most of it, might indeed have fallen under their control very fast. If this is true, then it suggests that the military crisis for the Ukrainians in Zaporozhye is deepening rapidly, and Malaya Tokmachka is located very close to Orekhov, and Orekhov presumably will be the target of attacks also very soon, though it has also been pointed out that from Malaya Tokmachka, the Russians can advance north, cut off the supply line from Orekhov to Gulyapolye. All of this whilst the Russians, following the capture of Poltavka, a little to the east, are in a position to cut off the supply lines to Gallipoli from the north. In other words, that what we could be looking at is an ongoing encirclement of Gallipoli, and that might be the Russian objective. Well, these are tactical details. I'm not going to discuss them. We'll just have to wait and see. And anyway, in the meantime, more reports of Russian advances in other places, in Dnipropetrovsk region, of fighting going on around Liman, the town of Liman, in the northern battlefields or close to it, of Russian attacks continuing on Siversk, fighting continuing in Siversk as well, and of the Russians now mopping up Volchansk and advancing south beyond Volchansk itself, the implication being that Volchansk has either fallen or any positions in Volchansk still under Ukrainian control being confined to a few small places. The same being true, by the way, in Kupiansk, west of the river. I've no doubt that the Russians control Kupiansk, all of the residential areas of Kupiansk, west of the river, and of course of the Ukrainians being trapped in this terrible cauldron on the east bank of the river as well, of the Oskol River as well. So the story is the same. Pokrovsk moving steadily and actually rapidly towards its fall. Russian preparations to storm Liman. An ongoing but difficult battle in Siversk, but nobody seriously doubts the outcome there. And a disaster in Kupiansk. And perhaps before long, a disaster in Zaporozhye as well. The remarkable thing is that all of these Russian advances are taking place during the period of the Rasputitsa, which I've heard is, by the way, particularly bad this time. But it doesn't seem to be slowing the Russians significantly. Now, at earlier times in the war, for example, in the late summer and early autumn of 2024, I remember that the Russians were advancing very fast as they pushed westwards from Avdeyevka. Every day they appeared to be capturing a village somewhere. But the point then was that most of these villages were scattered places and they weren't heavily fortified. It was clear that the Russians were able to advance quickly in open country. This has never really been disputed at any point in the war, and it was important that it was happening. But there were aspects of the battle last year which explained why. As I said, the Russians were not operating against well-established Ukrainian defences. Today again, every day, absolutely every day now, the Russians report villages and communities falling in Donbass, in Zaporozhye, usually two or three at a day. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's more than that, sometimes it's three. The point is that this time, all of these communities that are falling are integral parts of Ukraine's heaviest, most fortified defence line. And they tend to be surrounded by defensive structures. You can see this from the maps, the various trenches and trench positions that the Ukrainians have created. And nonetheless, the Russians are scooping them up rapidly, as I said, a day at a time, several each day. This has never happened in this war before. And it can only be explained by a Russian army that is much more powerful than it has been up to now, and by a Ukrainian army which is shrinking and withering away, or wasting away. All of which, of course, makes Western European determination and Ukrainian determination to keep the war going even less comprehensible. But anyway, this is where I'm going to stop. We'll see tomorrow whether this on again, off again summit meeting is going to be on again once more, whether the Hungarians are able to put things together. I suspect that in Moscow, more and more people are going to be increasingly fed up and are going to tell Putin, why, for heaven's sake, are we wasting our time? I suspect that if there has been a missile strike on the chemical factory in Bryansk, those voices are going to be still louder. But anyway, that will be all something to discuss in my next program. This is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar. Last but not least, don't forget to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And I forgot to mention, please also remember to check out our shop and our new Substack, which we have just started. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.